Hi, I'm Dr. Avanti Kumar Singh. In over 20 years of practicing both Western medicine and Eastern healing traditions, the most important thing that I've learned is that healing is a journey we take together. So on this podcast, I'll be demystifying Ayurveda and other integrated medicine, showing how these simple ancient practices are the keys to unlocking a healthy modern life. We are all healing catalysts because healing starts within. It starts with you, and it starts right now. This is a Soulfire production. Episode number 118. So, how many of you set a few New Year's resolutions and had the best intentions? And now it's 8 weeks later, the first week of March, and January and February are gone, and you really didn't follow through on all of those New Year's resolutions. Okay, raise your hand. No one can see you. I know I'm raising my hand. Well, don't worry. I've got you. Hello, my beautiful friends. Welcome back to the Healing Catalyst podcast. And if you raise your hand to not following through on your resolutions, you are going to love this episode, Bouncing Back When January and February Fall Short. I love the title of this episode. And speaking of New Year's resolutions, one of my big intentions going into this year was to collaborate with the people who I admire and respect and love, people who are doing amazing things in the world. And this podcast is part of that intention of collaboration. Now, there are a few reasons that this intention of collaboration is so important to me, especially this year. First, I get to do creative things with people that I respect and admire, and hopefully help more of you on your healing journeys. Second, I get to bring more joy and ease into everything that I do, because it's always more fun to do things with other people, and it's less stressful when you're having more fun. It's filled with more ease, as my friend Tara Stiles would say. And third, I get to experiment with new ideas and new ways of doing things. And so this podcast is also part of this collaboration experiment that I'm doing this year. So today I'm joined by Dr. Thanmeet Sethi, who many of you have heard on the podcast a few times before for a conversation about habits. And many of you also know that Dr. Thanmeet is one of my closest friends who is also a mentor, a colleague, and a sister to me, someone who I really look up to, who I deeply respect and admire, and someone whose work in the world is helping so many people heal. I thought that Dr. Thanmeet would be a great person to kick off my podcast collaborations with. And so today, you get to join us where we talk, as we do many times on the phone and over Zoom, as friends and colleagues. You all are going to get a chance to sort of be a fly on the wall, to listen in on our conversation about the things that we are thinking about and hearing about from our patients and our students, and even experiencing ourselves and with our families. This is the first of a series that we are calling Ignite, because we know that these conversations will ignite you to think about things differently and then try doing things differently. But before I get into the episode, let me introduce Dr. Thanmeet again for those of you who don't know her. Dr. Thanmeet Sethi is an integrative and psychedelic medicine physician, author, TEDx speaker, and activist who has dedicated her career to care for the most marginalized patients in Seattle's refugee, uninsured, and unhoused populations, as well as global communities traumatized by man-made and natural disasters, as senior faculty for the Center for Mind-Body Medicine. Her first book, Joy is My Justice, Reclaim Yours Now, was published in May of 2023 and is a radical call to claim joy as our birthright, the deepest liberation we can know, and a path to power through oppression. She's also a clinical associate professor at the University of Washington and a primary clinical investigator there on the sacred plant medicine psilocybin. In her clinical practice, she weaves modern and ancient medicine to catalyze the most profound healing. In our conversation, Dr. Thanmeet and I dive into what to do if you're thinking, oh my gosh, January and February just went by, and the first 8 weeks of the year are done. And I had all these aspirations and intentions and goals and habits of my New Year's resolutions, and I haven't done anything, or I'm not where I want to be, or any of those self-defeating negative thoughts that we all think. We discuss why resolutions often fail and the importance of understanding the difference between resolutions, goals, and habits. We also explain the neuroscience behind habit formation and of change, the brain's ability to adapt, and why seasonal alignment, also known as wintering, and self-compassion are critical for making lasting changes. And make sure that you stay until the end when we share practical strategies for making change and creating habits that stick. We also share our own personal struggles with habits. Yep, we also have trouble with this too. I am so excited to share with you my first Ignite conversation with Dr. Thanmeet Sethi about habit change and bouncing back when January and February fall short. Hi, Thanmeet. I'm so excited to be doing this with you today. I think a good place to start would be, why do New Year's resolutions fail, right? I mean, there's been some studies on this. The most sort of rigorous study is an old study on New Year's resolutions done at the University of Scranton. It shows that there is a very steep drop-off in New Year's resolutions, with 77% of the resolvers, the people who made New Year's resolutions in this study, that they made it through only a full week, 77%. So the first week of January, they were already falling off. After that, 55% of the people in the study were able to hold the resolutions for a month. And by June of that same year, only 40% of those who had made a New Year's resolution were still sticking with the goal. So this is a common issue. Like, a lot of us struggle with this. It's not like, you know, if you're listening to this, or even me and you thinking, oh my gosh, I couldn't do this. It's very common, so much so that they actually have named January 17th, which I guess is maybe like around the second Friday or Saturday of the year, they call it New Year's Resolutions Ditch Day. That's actually in pop culture because it's so common.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's that common that they've done studies about it.
I know. I wonder if, I mean, I don't know what you think about it, Avanti, but I wonder if it's because, partially at least, if it's because we confuse resolutions with the actual habits we're trying to cultivate.
What do you mean by that? Explain.
Well, it feels like I'm all for resolutions. I don't really make many anymore, but I think that what they are beautiful intentions. You know, they're aspirations for what we'd like for ourselves. And I think that that is so beautiful. And yet we confuse that aspiration with being something we can cultivate in a week or 2 weeks. You know, like, if your resolution, I think, is probably, let's just take the gym as like a classic one, right? Like, I'll go to the gym 5 times a week or whatever. It's a beautiful resolution. If we really call it a resolution, which is that I want to be healthier, I want to be someone who moves more. But then going to the gym 5 days a week actually isn't a resolution. It's a habit you want to cultivate. And we'll get into that probably, but cultivating a habit is a lot more than a week of trying something.
Yeah. No, I think that's actually a really good point. It's like, the resolution is like sort of a broad aspiration intention that you're sending, right? And what you're saying is about that we confuse those with these specific habits we want to create, and you can't do it in a week or 2 weeks or even a month, right?
And I, you know, before when we were talking about this, you had mentioned, for the listeners, you had mentioned like the difference between a resolution, a goal, and a habit. And I think that's like a beautiful distinction you were trying to make, is that if we look at what we're talking about, the resolution is that higher intention, that aspiration. So I want to be healthier.
Right.
The goal is I will move my body more, you know, and I will move my body more by going to the gym or whatever it is for
you. Right.
But the habit is I want to go to the gym 5 times a week, and that will become my habit.
Mm-hmm.
there's a big continuum there, right? And so the question is, you know, if you really understand what makes successful habits, then you're willing to stick through it more, I think, and understand that, first of all, I don't know if people understand this, but I had no idea about this ditch day date. That was news to me. It's pretty interesting. Yeah. But also, I think that there's a lot in the zeitgeist about, you know, change, 30 days makes a habit change. And it became, there was actually a lot of work around this that really shows when you dig into the literature that this whole idea that it takes 21 or 30 days to make a habit came, you know, back from a plastic surgeon in the 50s who had written some work around change, how long it took his patients to accept changes in their face, for instance. And there actually wasn't a lot tied to making a new habit. And when they really look at habit literature, it takes anywhere from 18 to 240 days, depending on how hard the habit is. That makes sense, right? Like, it's going to take much less time for me to get in the habit of drinking a glass of water when I wake up, and much more time for me to get in the habit of going to the gym 5 times a week. And the continuum is so broad that the average seems to fall somewhere around 66 days, which is actually March 6th, you know? And so takes at least, I would tell people, till March 6th to start making a new habit, even feel like you're moving into it. And by March, we've stopped talking about New Year's resolutions, right?
Yeah, which is why we're talking about it. And actually, I think this is going live on March 5th or 6th.
So this might be the time where we're saying, I didn't do it, or I did it, or, you know, kind of evaluating something that hasn't even had time to flourish.
Right. What's so interesting about what you said, there's a couple of things. Is that this idea, this false idea and belief that you can make a habit in 21 days or 30 days came from the work of a plastic surgeon talking about changes in the face that his patients, and then we extrapolated it to general life, which is crazy to me. I mean, that's super interesting. And I think that you're very right, is that, you know, there's this continuum. We do, in especially in the West, is we use a lot of different terms, but we collapse their meanings. So a resolution for so many people that I meet, and even sometimes in my own head and, you know, in my kids and stuff, you think of resolutions as the same thing as goals, as the same thing as habits. And it's like that continuum becomes one word or one idea. And that's why so many of us feel so shitty when we can't keep our resolutions, because they're mixed up with habits and goals, right? It's like, how can you achieve that if it's not actually achievable for most people just in life? But also, we're going to go into the brain, you know, the biochemistry of our brains and like how we work and why it is so hard. So it's not like it's your fault. This is not about willpower. I always say that it's about biochemistry, it's about behavior, which, you know, we're going to talk about. So those are some things that were coming up in my head. So.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that, you know, I try to talk about to myself, let's just say it, the real truth. I try to tell myself because I feel bad when I'm not doing what I want to do, right?
Yeah.
But also with my patients, but I mean, this is a human issue, not, you know, it's universal, is that, you know, there is, I think there's confusion too about change, that it's linear, that it looks like a graph, like a line, like nobody can see me, but I'm putting my hand diagonally, is that, you know, it's like change happens in this way and then you get to a different point. And really, change is a spiral. And when they do the behavioral literature around this, really, there is a misunderstanding that you're in contemplation around change, then you may take action and make the change, and then the change happens. There's pre-contemplation, contemplate, you know, and on and on. That is true. The misunderstanding is that that is on a slanted line on a graph. It actually looks more like a spiral staircase, is how I would have people envision it. And you slide up and you slide down, and you slide up and you slide down. And I always try to remind myself and my patients that success is being in the spiral. It's being in the act of making change. And when we fail, that actually is not the important part. What's important is what happens right after that. After we fail, are we taking a moment to say, okay, where am I in that spiral? Where am I to move up the spiral? And how can I use that failure as information for my success? And, you know this, but things like stopping smoking, if you look at the literature, you know, as a primary care doc, we're well aware that it takes at least 3 times to quit before success happens. What does that mean? That means somewhere along the first and second time, someone quote unquote failed. And if they had given up, they would not have gotten to the third time. So I think that's really important for people to remember that failure is information, and that's what's important.
Right. And what I think that's such an important point, because again, we always think of everything as linear. And that's sort of, again, the mindset of Western culture is that, you know, we're going to go from point A to point Z without any stops, without going backwards to, you know, the step before, the letter before. We're just going to keep going on that continuum. But what I think you're also saying is that it's like a process of contemplation, trying to make the change, failing, contemplating again, like went wrong, adjusting and going up again. So it's like is a spiral, like you're stopping and starting. I'm almost thinking about it like you're climbing a staircase, and it's, you know, most people, they're not going to climb the whole, you know, if it's 100 steps or something, you got to take a break for a second and reassess, catch your breath, right? It's sort of the same thing, like you're going to stop on that spiral staircase, take a moment, adjust, and then keep going, right? I don't know. Yeah. That was what I was thinking about.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, sometimes you take a little ride down the banister and yeah. then you come back, you know? And yeah. I mean, I think that's an important thing to remind myself and my patients, you know, just that it's not done now just because it didn't work this week or this month. It's not done. And I feel like it's also, I'm totally fascinated by what Ayurveda would say about, you know, should we even be doing this or trying this at this time, right? Are we in alignment? So what would you say about that?
I think it's a really good point because, you know, there's this idea that's actually come into a lot of sort of the Western consciousness about this idea of wintering. It's something we've been talking about in Ayurveda, right? We always talk about being in alignment with nature, living in harmony with nature's rhythms. And that's seasonal too. If you think about it, in the winter, which is January and February in most parts of the West, mm-hmm. it is, you know, above the equator. That is, you know, that's the time of winter. And that is not a natural time for nature to grow and evolve. It's actually a time for rest and reflection. So why are we any different, right? So we put all these ideas of changing because of the calendar year, you know, the new year, that calendar, that's not a lunar calendar or a solar calendar. It's just a date calendar, right? That we go by and we say January 1st is the start of the year. Let's do all these new things. It's also the middle of winter. It's not natural for us to take on all of these new things. Can we do it? Of course we can. And there's always exceptions to the rule. But I think that that's also one of the reasons it can be hard for a lot of people to implement resolutions, goals, habits, change in the midst of the winter. Because if you think about it, most of nature is resting, hibernating, getting ready to grow in the spring, right? And so actually, this March 6th date you told us about even, you know, the change, that's actually more in alignment with nature because we're going into the spring season when things are starting to bud, things are starting to sprout, the ground is starting to thaw, you know, the animals are coming out of hibernation. Same thing for us. So I find that so interesting that it actually all aligns. And I always tell people that it is very hard. I find it very difficult myself to make a lot of changes in the beginning of the year. Even though I want to intellectually.
That's so, I just think so empowering for people who are listening to think about how it's this date in March, and I'm actually getting closer to the time where my habits or resolutions, whatever you're calling them, could bud and bloom into something that actually not only is quote unquote failure useful piece of information in January and February, but I'm actually coming into alignment with the seasons and the earth. And now is the perfect time to think about that again. We made that intention, that aspiration for a good reason. Why not return to it? I love that.
Yeah. And so it's also the spiral staircase that you're talking about, right? Of having that intention, maybe trying, not having a lot of success. And maybe these are some of the reasons that we're talking about the wintering. We're going to talk about brain biochemistry. Those are some of the reasons that perhaps it didn't go so well. And so taking a moment to reflect and realize that these are some of the forces at play, some of the natural things at play. Okay, I'm going to recommit. I'm going to revisit and adjust accordingly. So one way that I know I've done that is that over the past few years, I've seen this pattern in myself that I set these intentions in January and I don't have a lot of success and I feel really bad about myself. And so I took a look at that and I realized this. I was like, oh, I'm going against nature. It's okay. I can set those intentions at the beginning of the year. It's a nice way to start off the year. But why not just see how things go, reflect on it, think about the person I want to be. And this comes to something you mentioned. I want to come back to that point. But then reevaluate and come back to it in the spring when it's more in alignment with nature and my own rhythms as a person. And I've found that I'm much more successful. And this goes to something you were talking about before we started, which is the idea of habit change comes from what is the person you want to be. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that? I thought it was really, really insightful and beautiful the way you talked about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think about it as who do I want to be who would do this habit? You know, why do I want to do it? And so I was telling you an example of a more recent habit in the last 6 months that I've cultivated, which is taking 8,000 minimum steps a day. And, you know, I'm not sedentary, but I wasn't getting a full 8,000, you know, and when I came to it, at first, I'll be honest, I made it as a goal first and was not working. You know, I couldn't fit it in. It was like becoming a logistical stressor, you know, and all this stuff. And it was dark, you know, wintry, because I started this in the fall as it was getting darker.
Right.
And then now when I shifted to what I'm trying to do is be someone who values and prioritizes movement every day, it changed everything. And it now is this thing that happens for me where if I only have 6,000 steps and it's the evening, I go for a walk. And I go for a walk not because I'm like, you have to go for a walk and get 8,000. I go because I say to myself, I'm the kind of person who knows that taking more steps now in the evening will help me. And just a lot about identity formation and makes it a little bit more around, less around productivity and hustling and making, getting something done, and more around cultivating who I want to be.
Yes. So. Yes. I think that's so important. And also, you brought up a really good point, which is I do think that we also collapse this idea of being productive and successful in life with being able to stick to our New Year's resolutions. Mm. Like it's synonymous. It's like some value judgment of you as a person. And that's why I also think it brings so much shame and like sort of like, oh my God, I can't believe I couldn't even keep my New Year's resolution, which is why this study is kind of funny to me because it's sort of like, oh my gosh, that person failed 1 week in, right? They couldn't even keep it, you know, keep their New Year's resolution for 1 week. It's good data and understanding to have, but it's sort of like, we're kind of shaming that person right there, you know, saying that you can only stick to it for a week, but what's the measure of, and this goes back to sort of what we were talking about before, what is the measure of being successful? The resolution. And is it because we're defining it in this kind of confusing way where we're saying the intention is the same thing as the goal, which is measurable, which is the same thing as actually doing the habit and stepping into this idea of being the person who does more movement or being the person who nourishes their body with more healthy choices of what they're eating, you know, or being the person who engages in healthy relationships or positive relationships, whatever the intention is, you know, there's a lot of confusion there.
I think this is such a big deal right now, what we're talking about. I want to pin it in my own mind for later in the conversation, because what is really striking me about what you're saying is that when we do what you're saying about that we all do about, oh, I didn't do it for more than a week or, you know, whatever, what we're doing is not only not going into the aspiration of who we want to be, we're also assigning an identity of being someone who fails at everything or doesn't get it done. Like you were saying, you feel bad. And it actually connects back to one of the biggest success points of what makes change happen. So let's talk about habits first, I think, but I'm pinning that for myself for everyone in the after to get to, because I think you really just struck a really important chord.
Okay. Yeah, let's get into it. So let's talk about what, you know, sort of the sciences behind habits, maybe the neurochemistry, the biochemistry. It's about something called neuroadaptability or neuroadaptation. And that's really this idea that the brain can adapt to whatever you do. It can be health supporting or health weakening, but the brain doesn't actually, it doesn't have an opinion. It can't tell the difference. It's just adapting, right? It sees biochemistry. Anytime there's something that's out of the ordinary, and it can be, quote, positive or negative, the brain doesn't see it that way. It just sees a surge of dopamine because there's something happening. There's some stressor, positive or negative, that's happening, something different. And it says, oh, that feels really good. I love this, right? But at the same time, it sees it as a stress. And so some things cause a bigger dopamine surge than others, like, you know, drugs and alcohol, certain foods, you know, that can cause a bigger dopamine surge than, let's say, a hug from a friend for some people, you know, or for a lot of people, just because of the amount of dopamine that's released, right? And so your brain only sees that there's this surge of dopamine that's not normal. And so it tries to adapt to protect itself, because your brain is always trying to maintain balance or allostasis, right? To be in this state of balance, of sort of like being in homeostasis.
Right, right.
Right. And so it'll do whatever it has to do to protect itself. So it starts to turn off some of the dopamine receptors in the brain, which means that the environment is more stable in your brain, but then that means also that you need more dopamine to get the same effect. So mm-hmm. I know I've said a lot of things there, but basically it's biochemistry. Your brain is trying to protect yourself. And that's why habit change comes slowly and can be hard.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that was really important to understand though, because I think we blame ourselves as some, like we're a failure at doing things when we don't understand that our brain is just doing what it knows to do. And I think of it also as, it's the same concept, but I think of it as these sort of roads that the brain lays down, these neural pathways, that they're pathways and roadways. And that the more we cue ourselves for an habit that then feels that reward you're talking about, the more cemented those roadways become. And the brain, like you said, doesn't differentiate between good or bad, healthy, unhealthy. It also wants the easiest way. It wants to take the least resistance pathway. And that will be the road that is laid down the smoothest and the strongest. And so, you know, if your goal is to make a habit of eating more vegetables, I'm just taking common ones that people have. If there are other foods in your sight before you get to the vegetables in the fridge that you usually eat, your brain is not trying to sabotage you. It's taking the easiest, oh, we know that pathway. We eat that now, you know? And it's why the neuroscience, the literature shows that you are three times more likely to eat something in the front of your cupboard or on the counter than you are something in the back of the cupboard. And so, you know, because it's harder to rummage in the back. What are, you know, we already found something easy in the front. And, you know, it's not about not, and really, I am with you, this willpower myth is horrible. It's not about willpower. It's about if the cookies are in front of the cupboard, then that's what your brain will take. And so, you know, I think it's really important for people to understand that the biochemistry you're describing and these pathways, they're there and they're long and they're deep. And then to change them and keep making a small fork out to a new pathway takes time to lay down new gravel. And it's okay. We just keep going and we try until that becomes a smooth pathway.
Right. That's amazing. And that, like, so what I'm thinking about as you're saying that is that that's why people will say, if you have a coach trying to help you through, you know, creating a new habit, they'll say, you know, get rid of as many of the sweets as you can, clean out your cupboards. If that's your intention to eat more fresh vegetables, keep the fruit on the counter. So it's the first thing your brain sees and says, oh, that's easy. Let me eat that. I mean, that's almost a practical way of what you're saying, right? Even to go exercise, put your clothes out, make it simple. Right. Like, don't make it that you have to go, you know, here, there, and everywhere to go and do some movement. Make it simple, and as simple as walking out your front door when you're starting.
Yes. Yes. Right? I mean, I'll tell the listeners, when I'm trying to get up at 5 to go to yoga class or go row or go work out, I wear my clothes to bed.
Do you really? That's awesome.
Because if I get out of bed in my pajamas, I can think of a million ways to not change into my clothes. It's cold. I don't feel like it. Maybe I should do this first. Whatever. I'm only human. My husband makes fun of me. He's like, are you literally going to sleep in those leggings? I'm like, yep, I am. And some people, you don't have to be so drastic as
no,
I am.
But it's exactly the point. It's great.
Yeah. But some people lay it out on the ground on the doorway to the bathroom so that they have to step on it to get, you know, some people just, you know, keep their shoes right at the door, that kind of thing. I mean, and I think that it's not only important to understand your brain needs, I look at it as support. I don't look at it as I'm not good enough to get up and change into my clothes. I need support to help me make a choice I want to make. Right. But I have not smoothed a pathway deep enough to do yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, that's how it is.
I think it's amazing. I think this idea of your brain is looking for the easiest path. So make it easy. And so put that stuff in front of your brain, in front of your sight, so that your brain says, oh, look, the shoes are right there. Oh, I'm already in the leggings. You know, it's a very practical, you know, application of what we're talking about with this brain biochemistry. And I think actually it's helpful because when you understand that that's how your brain is working, then you're like, okay, let me do these things that's just going to help my brain, right? I think it's brilliant. It's really, 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 I'm having a bazillion ahas right now as we're talking. Like, I mean, I know this brain, you know, biochemistry and neuroscience, but I don't think I ever thought about it with why that is so connected to change, habit formation, by doing these little things like, you know, laying the clothes out or putting the fruit on the counter or whatever it is. It's directly connected to that. It's pretty cool.
Yes. And I think it also connects for anyone listening who's gone through the feeling not good enough to make a change. First of all, I would say welcome to the human race. It's hard to make change. Yeah. And counsel people on change every day. And I find it difficult. There's no right intellectual way to get around how hard this is.
Right.
At the same time, I think that that kind of making it easy for your brain is also making it easy for you to have compassion for yourself. We'll probably talk about this more, but I can't tell you that is the fundamental way to make change is to get out of this, I am not good enough, I'm a failure, I'm a loser, and get into the compassionate self. And there's lots of reasons which we could get into, but
let's get into it. Let's go there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all neuroscience. It's not I mean, well, you could call it woo, but then it's neuroscience woo, and I'll take it.
Yeah.
But the truth is that we have, the way I see it, we have confused accountability with shame. So,
Wait. Oh, that's good. Wait, okay. We've confused accountability with shame. Mic drop. Okay, please go. I have to think about that for a second.
So if we quote unquote fail at a habit, then we move into shame. We think that compassion, saying it's okay, you'll try again tomorrow, it's okay, you had too much today going on, or whatever we say to ourselves, that that will then, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but I think it's right for most humans, that will then weaken our accountability to doing it right the next day. We've let ourselves off the hook, as they say. And then we shame ourselves. You're a loser. You can't do this. You need to be better, on and on. But there is never, I have looked in every dictionary, there is no accountability definition that includes shaming yourself. And what you can do instead is use self-compassion to give yourself accountability. And what I'm saying is that if you keep telling yourself you're a loser and you can't do this and you fail, your brain sees it as threat. Your amygdala, your fear center sees it as a threat. Imagine if a bully yelled at you or someone was physically or verbally abusing you and telling you what a loser you are. There's not anyone listening who would disagree that it makes you feel horrible. But that's what we're doing to ourselves all day. And when we move into that amygdala in our fear center, we move out of our frontal cortex, our center of clarity, our center of executive decision, our center of awareness, our center to make change.
Right.
Plain and simple. If anyone here has a teenager or has ever been a teenager, you will know that if your parent says, "I can't believe you did that again, can't you learn?" Only feel bad and you do it again. And the reason is because when we're in stress and threat, we reach for survival comfort. And usually that's the thing we're trying to change. So the reason you want that food that you don't want to eat again, but you're eating it now at night, you're not sure how that happened, is because you feel bad about yourself and you want comfort. And that has brought you comfort. So self-compassion is at the root of all of it. You know, it is, if you cannot love yourself through change, it will be hard to make the change you want to make.
Yes. Okay. There's so many things. So the first thing I want to go back to is accountability and shame. I want you to explain that again, because I need a little clarification. Because what you're saying is that when you say you're going to do something, this habit, right? I'm going to go for a walk every morning. Let's make it simple. And you don't end up doing it. And you tell yourself you're a loser. You're not, what's wrong with you? You can't do anything, blah, 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 right? You go into that whole negative spiral. You're shaming yourself. How does that go back to accountability? Can you tell me that?
Let's break it down. We do that because we think that if we say to ourselves, you're okay, you made a mistake, you'll try again, that we're going, quote unquote, too easy on ourselves, then we'll never get to our goal. If we shame ourselves, we're not conscious of it. We're not saying, I want to shame myself. But when we shame ourselves, what we're doing is saying to ourselves, you could have done better. You need to do this better.
Right.
Right?
It's accountability. You're thinking it's accountability.
You think it is.
Yes.
Because I'll do better than if I tell myself that was wrong.
Right.
The truth is you can be accountable and compassionate in the same breath.
Yes. Yes.
You can say to yourself, this just happened to me today, by the way. You can say to yourself, you got up too late to do the workout you wanted to do. I could either say, I can't believe you didn't get up. As if, you know, there's something inherently bad about me because I didn't get up. But that is the first thing I hear. I'll be honest. The first thing I hear is, I can't believe you didn't get up. And then I have to shift. You didn't get up. You must have needed sleep. How can we course correct this? That's still accountability, but it isn't shameful.
It's compassion. I get what you're saying. You're saying that most of us what we do if we're trying to be accountable is we end up shaming ourselves. Instead of when we're accountable, we can be compassionate with yourself, with ourselves.
Yes.
Right? Am I getting that right?
Yes. And there are studies to show, both with food and alcohol, really, I mean, just fascinating studies to show that people, I'll take the alcohol, for instance, these were not people who consider themselves alcoholics. These are people who consider themselves as wanting to drink less socially for whatever reason.
Okay.
If those people drink more than they wanted to, and they beat themselves up the next day, compared to the people who give themselves compassion, the people who beat themselves up are more likely to drink again the next night. They do this with food. The people who were taught mindful compassion were able to eat less donut. I mean, they use all these foods. They were able to eat less donuts than the ones who were telling themselves, you should be able to resist this.
Okay. Got it.
Every time it works.
Yeah.
And the reason is because it's not only because it feels better, which it does, but it's because if we're in a compassionate state, we literally are in a more aware state in our frontal cortex where change is made. And we're out of the threat center where we are in attack mode and we feel threatened. And when we are threatened and stressed, we cannot and we do not understand not only how to make the decision, they have actually done studies to show that we do not even understand or remember the consequences of those decisions.
You know, so
how many times has anyone listening? I mean, I've done this. You want to eat healthier and you end up at the fridge late at night eating something and standing there thinking, I'm not even sure how this happened because you're in a state of stress and non-aware.
Right. Right.
So it makes a difference.
Right. And so it's all connected because it's the brain biochemistry, which is, you know, so the shame puts you into a stress state because it's a stressor, the shame, and that sets off this dopamine surge, which your brain doesn't know which is better or worse, right? It just says it's a dopamine surge. Let me protect myself. That's also why you need more and more and more of something to make yourself feel better, right? Because you already feel shitty when you shame yourself. And so you're like, oh, I need to feel better. So then you go and do the exact habit that you're trying to change, which is go have a glass of wine, or you go eat some ice cream, or whatever it is that you're trying to change. Or you don't go to the workout because you feel better just sitting on the couch, right? Your brain's trying to protect itself. Plus the executive functioning, which you're talking about. It's fascinating. And also what I'm coming back to is this idea that when you are more compassionate, you're also in that place of who is the person I want to be, right? That is what I'm thinking about.
I love that. I think what you're saying, I'm having an aha moment. What you're saying is that if you stay in that compassionate state, then you can say after, you know, you mess up or slip or whatever, that, oh, but who is it I want to get back to? Who is it I want to return to instead of I'm a loser?
Yes.
I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I have to confess, I'm not sure if the self-berating surges dopamine. I'm not sure. I'd have to look at that because what I know from the science and literature is that it actively heightens cortisol, our stress hormones, and really inhibits this ability to stay in that aware state. But that makes sense to me. I just haven't looked at it. But I think that this idea, I'm having another aha moment, is that this Ayurvedic perspective of wintering also makes it so connects to compassion, is that if you're listening and you've fallen off a habit that you wanted to make, have compassion for yourself, that it wasn't easy to do in the first place. You know, if you're looking at alignment with nature and seasons, we were working uphill. And if you went forward, great. But, you know, if you didn't, it was a boulder that was too hard to push. And let's try again on flatter ground, you know? Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And that comes back to sort of that, you know, pattern I was seeing, is that it was really hard for me to, you know, really get into these different habits that I wanted to sort of commit to. in the middle of winter. I saw that pattern. And so I said to myself, okay, what's really going on here for me? And that was from a compassionate place. It wasn't from a place of shaming myself. And it was also not saying that I'm not going to do this. Oh, I didn't do it in January, so forget it. I didn't do it in February, so forget it. It's sort of like, oh, what was the reason? Like, can I see what's really going on from an Ayurvedic lens and also from a biochemical, you know, physiology lens and behavioral, and see how does that play for me? How does that feel when I think about those things? And I'm like, this makes sense. And so from a place of compassion, I told myself, if I want to be the person who incorporates whatever habit it is over this next calendar year, because I set it as a New Year's resolution on January 1st, and now it's March 1st or March 6th, let me do it from a place of compassion of the person I want to be. And step into that.
Yes. And do you want to be a person who only sees what hasn't happened or what is possible, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah. I think too, I mean, you know this from my book, is that patients always come back and are scared to tell me, you know, that they didn't achieve a change that we tried to implement.
Right.
And then invariably they say, Dr. Sethi, I slipped up. And I literally say this constantly. I just look at them and I say, it's a slippery world. You know, like, you are not broken. This is hard, you know? And literally they will delay their appointment or cancel it because they will say, I was scared to tell you I didn't do it. And, you know, I just feel so much empathy for that because we're all out there slipping and sliding all over the place. And sometimes we slide into a place that feels good, and sometimes it feels like we failed. But if we keep moving in the spiral, we're getting somewhere.
Yes, absolutely. It actually brings up, you know, sort of the experience I've had with patients too, when I'm coaching them through sort of an Ayurvedic program where they're learning all of these new habits that are Ayurvedic, you know, in origin, and they're trying to apply them to their lives, and they'll have, you know, an appointment set up with me, and then they delay, and they're like, well, I didn't really incorporate the habit, and I don't know if I should come to the next meeting. And many times I'll say to them, well, you know, it's really up to you. And I also want to offer this to you, that perhaps it would be helpful to talk about what obstacles you're coming up against. What are the things that are happening that you are feeling like you're not able to achieve it? You know, because many times they've actually been able to incorporate the habit, but it's not exactly as perfect as they wanted, or you know, it's not exactly how they imagined it would be. And I find that sometimes that helps them to have some compassion for how they're going about bringing a habit change. So I see the same thing.
I love that, because I think what you're saying is they come and whatever obstacles they faced are now information for the both of you to move further on the spiral, right?
Exactly. It's that, exactly that. It's like, let's take just a moment and sit down on the steps and talk about it, reassess, adjust, and then let's go to the next step. It's sort of that exact thing. So we've been talking for a while and we've been talking about so many ideas. Let's make this like really practical for people of like, where do they start? What do they do? What are some of the things that you know, you teach a lot about habit change. You've lectured on it. Do this a lot. What are some of the things that you tell students, patients, people who are listening to you speak, people who are listening to this podcast? What would you tell them to do if they're trying to? Maybe we can make it really practical. Let's use an example. I don't know if you want to use a gym or whatever example. Let's use an example and
okay,
do it that way.
Before I get to the example, I would say the first thing I would tell them is to understand the myths that we've talked about. Yes. One, willpower is not real. It actually and we didn't talk about this, but it will activate your stress system. It does not work. It is not a failure of you as a human. Mm-hmm. Two is that failure is information and success is staying in the spiral.
Yes.
And so those are the things that I would say to make sure that you embody in some way today that you understand. Mm-hmm. Then I would say that if you're trying to make habit change, the practical things I would say are, one, make it easy.
Yes.
Let it be easy. Mm-hmm. You know, if you always buy a food that you don't want to buy on the way home, you know, that you want to stop eating, take a different route home.
Yes, yes.
You know, and you really think about it, like, how can I make this easy? If you want to eat more vegetables, spend an hour Sunday cutting them all up and putting them in containers so that during the week, they're easy to get out from your fridge. Mm-hmm. You know, put your gym clothes on. I mean, you don't have to put them on.
Sleep in them. I love
sleep it. Sleep with them.
I'm going to do it.
So, you know, make it easy. Mm-hmm. Secondly, make it fun. The reason you started the habit to begin with was because there was some reward you got. You may not see it now because you may see it as an evaluation that it's an unhealthy habit, but there was some reward, some comfort, something, some kind of dopamine surge that Avanti talked about.
Yeah.
And so make it fun now to do another habit. Mm-hmm. If you need to pair going to the gym with listening to your favorite music, or every time I go to the gym, I get to, you know, do something that I want to do. Every time I eat more vegetables, I also get to call my best friend. I don't know what it is, something not an unhealthy pairing, but pair it, because then you start to make new cues and new rewards for your habit. And the biggest thing is have compassion for yourself through the process. When you're making your goals and habits, when you're outlining them, understand that you can make them as realistic and doable as you can. When you slip up, understand that it's a slippery world. When you feel bad about yourself, then realize that having compassion for myself right now will make this easier for me to move into the habit again. Do not If, and I'm telling you, I heard in my own mind this morning first, why didn't you get up? It is human. You don't stop hearing the bad. What you do is slip from the bad into compassion more easily. Mm-hmm. So understand that. You're going to hear that berating. It's your brain's job to do that. Mm-hmm. So those are the things I would tell people to do and tell. And I really, really, really love this reminder of aligning with the seasons. And so it's March 6th tomorrow, maybe. It's your next chance. It's a second chance. Where I live, frost date is March 21st, I know, for my garden. And, you know, things are going to start being able to bud.
Right.
And so will I. So will you. Mm-hmm. So, you know, give yourself a second chance with compassion and make it easy and fun. And let this be something that allows you to turn into who you want to be.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I absolutely.
What would you add, Avanti? Yeah.
No, I mean, I think those are beautiful suggestions and strategies. And I think that this, you know, the one that I keep coming back to is this idea of wintering and aligning and giving yourself some grace and compassion and understanding. I mean, you know, many of you who have been listening to this podcast, this is a podcast about Ayurveda and integrative medicine and integrative healing. And so much of what we do in Ayurveda is all about living with the natural world, with living with nature and seasonal alignment and daily alignment. And we know that our physiology with our circadian rhythms, we actually align to nature. That's how our bodies work. Our minds work that way. So it also applies to something as big as habit change, because it is big, you know. Yeah. It is big. It's no small thing. And I think that we make it seem like it's so easy to do. It's,
yeah. Yeah.
It's not. It's something that requires that compassion and also the ease. Easy and ease are not the same thing, right?
Right.
Creating ease in something is coming from a compassionate place. So I think just keeping that in mind of this idea of wintering, and winter is a season for reflection and rest, now allow yourself to step into that person you want to be, which is the reason you set that intention anyway, right?
Right.
Go back to it, maybe look at it as the person I want to be, the compassionate, rather than looking at as another thing to achieve, more productivity, more hustle. Because I think we're so in that energy in this world of always having to feel like we're doing something, that we're producing something, achieving something.
Yeah. You know? And you gave me a line just now in that whole description that I'm going to use in my compassion when I slip up, which is that I really mean this. I don't know. Tell me if this is the right take on it, but I feel like, first of all, this morning, I can just say I was wintering when I slept in.
Yes.
Right? Like, yes. I was wintering. My body for needed sure. more rest.
Absolutely.
But I'm thinking about even in April, July, as the year goes on, when it's not winter, I actually feel like, you know, we have periods of wintering, and I'm going to use that as sort of like, you know, in this day or this week, I need to winter a little bit, and I might not be able to do everything I expected of myself. And so I'm going to use this in my speak to myself as a way to give myself more compassion so that I can stay in alignment and awareness, right?
Yes, I love it. And it's actually something that Catherine May talks about in her book, Wintering. Really good book. And she talks about this idea of cold moments, the life's cold moments, and that, you know, those times of challenge, of grief, of sadness, of whatever might be a little difficult, right? That is a time to go into that wintering mode. So it's exactly what you're talking about. It's saying to yourself, I'm in this cold moment today, this week, this month, and it could be any time of the year, and allowing yourself to go into that wintering mode of rest and reflection and rejuvenation, and then coming back into that springtime of, okay, now I'm ready to move forward. I've reflected, and now I can go to the next season, even though it might be the next week, right? I think it's a very useful way of thinking about it. I love what you just said.
I am using that as myself. Thank you. I'm putting that in my self-compassion speak.
Yeah, no, I love it. I love it. Okay, we've talked about so much. We could keep going, but I know we've already been talking for an hour. So
have we?
Yeah, we have.
It's too easy. There's too much ease.
It's so much ease. I love this. This has been so much fun. Our first experiment with this kind of collaboration has been amazing. I have a feeling we're going to be doing this a lot more, like a lot more. We'll have to talk
online.
Yes. Thami, thank you so much for doing this with me. You know how much I love you, and I just love talking to you, and I learn so much from you, and it just activates so many more things for me to think about in the way that I think about it for myself, but also how I think about it for the people that I'm helping. And so I get so much from these conversations. And so I thank you. And I hope that all of you who are listening just got, you know, a really wonderful peek into the conversation between two friends who do a lot of work in the world where we're trying to help people. So,
yeah, thank you. Ditto. I mean, I've done so much work around habits, and I got just beautiful new gems today. So I just love how much more can happen when two people are sharing perspectives and experience.
Yes. So we'll do it again. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to The Healing Catalyst. If you love what you heard, please hit follow and pass it along to a friend. And if you're feeling really inspired, please rate and review so that others can find this podcast more easily. To learn more, head to avantikumarsingh.com. And to connect with me directly, find me on Instagram at avantikumarsingh. I'll be back next week and hope that you will be too. Until then, remember, with the right catalyst, you have the power to activate your own healing, because healing starts within.